Hi, my name is Deb Quintel. I'm the Director of Curriculum Development with CALI, and I'm sitting here today with Professor Scott Burnham from the University of Montana School of Law. Welcome, Professor Burnham. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Deb. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, today we're going to be talking about parole evidence. And I know you've written a lesson for CALI in parole evidence, and I want to ask you some related questions if I could. The first thing I want to ask is, what makes parole evidence so very hard to understand?
It's one of those areas of contract law where the rule turns on the intention of the parties. And I think any part of contract law is difficult where you have to determine the party's intention.
So would determining the party's intention be your tip to students for trying to understand this?
Well, that comes later down the road. I think the first step to understand it is to narrow it down, to understand what the parole evidence rule is not. And let me start with what it is. What it is simply trying to find the contract the parties made. And the issue is always whether the contract the parties made is just the writing that they signed or the writing plus some oral promises and representations. So what it's not is it's not about modification, because modification comes after. We're talking about the formation of the contract initially. So modification's a completely different issue. It's also not about interpretation, because we have to find the contract before we can interpret what it might mean. So parole evidence comes before interpretation. And it's also not about formation, that if there are issues like mistake or fraud or duress, those are not parole evidence issues. So if we can narrow it down to just that question of, is the agreement just the writing or the writing plus some oral stuff, then we have a parole evidence rule issue.
And does parole evidence rules differ state by state?
Yes, I think it does. But for that, we're going to have to get into that question of the intent of the parties. Because let me state the rule. Here's a statement of the rule. The rule is that once the parties have reduced their agreement to a writing that they intend to be the final and complete statement of their agreement, then evidence may not be offered to supplement or contradict the agreement. The key there is that phrase, agreement that they intend to be final and complete. And many states leave that out and simply say, once the parties reduce the agreement to writing, then you can't have oral supplements to that written agreement. That is not the parole evidence rule. It's a very bad statement of it, because it elevates a writing to a place that it was never intended to have. That you have to always ask under the parole evidence rule, did the parties intend for that writing to be their entire agreement, or did they intend the writing to be supplemented with other understandings? And how you answer that question may vary from state to state.
Let me ask you another question. How can a person differentiate between two separate contracts and parole evidence?
That's a very good question, and it relates to what I was saying about things that are not the parole evidence rule, that there's nothing wrong with having two separate agreements, one of which is written and one is oral. Again, with the exception of the statute of frauds, there's nothing wrong with oral agreements. So there's nothing wrong with having two agreements, one written and one oral. So, for example, if we are talking about you're buying my house, and there's a refrigerator in the house, and you say, does the refrigerator come with it? And I say, no, but I'll sell it to you for an extra $400. And you say, that's a deal. We then write up an agreement for the sale of the house, and we don't mention anything about the refrigerator. So we have a written agreement for the sale of the house. You then buy the house, and there's no refrigerator in it. And you say, wait a minute, where's the refrigerator? And I say, ha ha, that's not mentioned in the writing. And under the parole evidence rule, then you can't introduce evidence of our agreement. Well, of course, in that situation, you can introduce evidence of the agreement because we have two agreements, one written agreement for the sale of a house and the other an oral agreement for the sale of a refrigerator. And as long as it's under $500, there's nothing wrong with an oral agreement for the sale of a refrigerator. Now, here's where the problem comes up. So there's a situation where you have two separate agreements, nothing to do with the parole evidence rule. Here's the other hypothetical. I'm selling you my house, and you say, what about the refrigerator? And I say, I'll include the refrigerator. Now we drop the written agreement. We don't mention the refrigerator. You move into the house, and you say, where's the refrigerator? I say, ha ha. You say, but you promised me the refrigerator. My answer to that is, ha ha, no consideration. That I simply said, I'll include the refrigerator. So now we have a consideration issue. So how can we provide some consideration that you gave me for the refrigerator? The only answer for you is to argue that what you're paying for the house includes both the house and the refrigerator. To make that argument, you're going to have to say that the sale of the refrigerator is part of the sale of the house. Now we have a true parole evidence rule issue. That is, did we intend our agreement to be just the writing, which excludes the refrigerator, or did we intend our agreement to be partly written and partly oral, in which case it could include the refrigerator? So that's the clear difference there, that in almost always in a parole evidence rule issue, the side promise or representation will not be separately enforceable because it lacks consideration. And the only way to provide the consideration is to make it part of the entire agreement.
That was a great example. Thank you. Let me ask you another question. You've mentioned the statute of frauds here a couple times. Could you explain how the statute of frauds interacts with the parole evidence rule?
Well, I would say it doesn't interact, that, again, you want to keep these separate. The only thing they have in common is the issue of whether an oral promise is enforceable. And so the statute of frauds is simply saying there are certain categories of contracts that aren't enforceable unless they're evidenced by a writing, like the UCC statute of frauds that sale of goods, $500 or less, is not enforceable unless evidenced by a writing. As I mentioned, the parole evidence rule does have to do with the enforceability of oral promises or representations, but it's not a statute of frauds issue. It's not related to the type of contract. It's simply related to whether that oral promise is part of the agreement or not. So as I mentioned, the refrigerator situation, the issue there again is whether the promise of the refrigerator is part of the contract or not part of the contract. It has nothing to do with the statute of frauds.
Let me ask you, how is integration determined, and how does it relate to contradictory and supplemental evidence that a court will or will not admit?
That goes back to the key question we mentioned, that whether the side oral promise is enforceable or not depends on the intent of the parties. So everything turns on where do you find the party's intent. Again, did they intend that writing to be their entire agreement or not? So the word integration or merger means that they did intend the writing to be the entire agreement if it's an integrated agreement or if everything is merged in that writing. So how do you determine that? Well, one theory, the objectivist theory, is you look at the agreement, the written agreement, and if it says this writing is intended to be the entire understanding of the parties, that's what we call a merger clause or integration clause, and for the pure objectivist, that's evidence of the party's intent. If they said in the agreement, this is the entire agreement, then we don't need to look any further. But a more modern view would say that kind of clause is usually buried in boilerplate in the back of the agreement. So could a provision that's hidden away that nobody read or paid attention to really indicate the intention of the parties? And shouldn't you look beyond that for the parties' intentions? And that's the struggle in the parole evidence rule issues, is to find the party's intention in a meaningful way and not just that pure objectivist merger clause way. So the parole evidence rule would say then that once you've determined that the agreement is integrated, then you can't allow in evidence to supplement it or contradict it. But, you know, in reality, most courts give weight to the writing, and I'm not sure that that's correct. Let me give you an example. Suppose we have a lease, and we're negotiating a lease between landlord and tenant, and the written lease says no pets, and the tenant says, oh, I have a declawed cat. Is it okay if I have a declawed cat? The landlord says, no problem. They sign the written agreement. A month later, the landlord says, you have a cat in the apartment, you're evicted. You say, but wait a minute, you told me that I could have my declawed cat. Landlord says, ha ha, the written agreement says no pets. Therefore, that governs over our oral understanding. So on the one hand, we have a writing that says no pets. We have an oral understanding that says declawed cat, okay. The parole evidence rule would ask, did we intend the entire agreement to be evidenced just by that writing, in which case the landlord's going to win, or did we intend the written agreement to be supplemented or contradicted by other understandings, in which case the tenant's going to win? Well, again, most courts are going to say that because the oral understanding contradicts the writing, that that oral understanding will not be admitted. And I'm not sure that's right, because it seems to me that there is no preference for writings over oral understandings, but in contemporary usage, we do often give the writing more weight, and the landlord's often going to win in that situation.
Well, you raise an interesting point here. As I'm listening to you talk, you're mentioning disagreeing with courts and different viewpoints and things like that, and that brings me to my last question, which are, could you sort of summarize some of the major differences that you see between the restatement's views of integration and that of Williston and Corbin?
Yes, Williston is, of course, the pure objectivist. Williston would say, again, this is all on that issue of how do we determine the party's intent. So Williston would say, first, look for a merger clause. And if there's a merger clause in the agreement, then that's the end of the story. That demonstrates that the parties did intend the writing to be complete and final, so we're not going to admit anything oral. If there's no merger clause, Williston would then say, well, what would reasonable people do in this situation? In other words, would a landlord and tenant make a side oral agreement about something that was the subject matter of the contract already? And he would probably say, no, they wouldn't, because they said no pets in the contract. If they were going to allow pets, then wouldn't they have simply change the wording of the contract instead of having a side agreement? So he looks entirely at objective evidence. What's in the contract? What would reasonable people do? Corbin takes a more subjective view and says, well, that merger clause may not be meaningful as an indication of the party's intent because it probably wasn't really negotiated. And Corbin would say, shouldn't we look at what these people actually did in this situation rather than what some hypothetical people might do? So that if this landlord and this tenant agreed that a cat would be okay, shouldn't that be given some weight rather than just look at what some abstract theoretical landlord-tenant would do? The restatement is more of the Corbyn position. The restatement says a merger clause may be some evidence of the party's intention to have the entire agreement integrated in the writing, but it's not conclusive. And the restatement allows for more of that subjective evidence of what the parties actually did. So going back to your first question, then, this is what makes the parole evidence rule issue hard and makes it difficult to pin down in terms of what is the rule in each state. That there's quite a spectrum of possible outcomes in any situation that falls under the rule, and it's very hard to predict what that outcome is going to be. In fact, there was a very interesting study by two professors at NYU who said, you know, you can pretty much determine how a parole evidence rule issue is coming out just by looking at the relationship between the parties. And if the parties both had negotiating power and negotiated the agreement freely, then courts are generally going to take a strict view and say, if you didn't get it in writing in the agreement, we're not going to let it in. But if it's more of a consumer situation, where one party had more bargaining power and the other had to simply adhere to the written agreement, then they're going to be more relaxed and say, we may allow in that evidence of the outside agreement. So it's a very fact-specific situation and very difficult to determine a priori what the result in a parole evidence rule situation is going to be.
Well, Professor Burnham, thank you very much for discussing parole evidence with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Deb. It's been a pleasure.